It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down landmark decisions this term that will affect people everywhere. We dig deeper into the rulings, what they mean, with a pair of Supreme Court scholars. What did you think of the high court decisions with a conservative supermajority? Besides the blockbuster overturning of Roe, what decisions were notable that didn't attract headlines? Join in throughout the hour, 800-642-1234. Sarah Benish is associate professor and chair of political science in the College of Letters and Science at UW-Milwaukee, teaches a course on SCOTUS. Sarah, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
And hi, Timothy Johnson is Horace T. Morse Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Law at the University of Minnesota, studies the court's decision-making, oral arguments, the role of precedent through time. Timothy, welcome back.
I appreciate having me this morning.
Well, Timothy, let's start with you. Some legal scholars say this new Supreme Court majority has really moved quickly into the new era of conservatism on the court. And even though, you know, Chief Justice John Roberts warned about giving serious jolts to the legal system, is the court moving fast compared to history?
You know, it looks as though the court is moving quite quickly. If you look at data going all the way back to 1937, which is generally the data that political scientists use to analyze decision making on the court, this is actually the single most conservative court in almost 100 years. By that, I mean that the percentage of decisions that would be coded by political scientists in the liberal direction is the lowest it has been since 1937. And so, I mean, that's actually a big movement. And as you said, very quickly has this been done. And given the cases that the court has already set in its docket for next term, it seems that it will continue to move at this quick pace.
Yes. Sarah, you know, as we hear there about this pace and, you know, the label of it being an activist court, what do these rulings tell you about the court's conservative majority?
Yeah, I think it's really a key holding for this term that this conservative majority has really coalesced on this new originalism project. And it's not a new project, but it's a new opportunity for a majority of the court to start really using originalism as the legal reasoning in some pretty important cases. And you mentioned at the top the Dobbs case as probably the most prominent. But there have been originalism, you know, adherents on the court for a long time, but we've not had five willing to go forward and push constitutional law in a really strong originalist direction so far. And so I think that is one of the reasons why we see this particular court as particularly conservative and also as particularly activist.
And Sarah, step back for a moment, if you will. How do you explain originalism to people outside the legal community?
Well, there's a debate over how a judge should interpret the Constitution. And there's generally two sides to the debate. One arguing that we should interpret the Constitution as it was intended when it was written. So what the founders thought about the various provisions of the Constitution ought to be what drives decision making today. And then the other school argues that we ought to use a more living Constitution idea where we recognize that the Constitution that was written long ago has to evolve with the times to apply better to our current problems. So the idea that we ought to rely on the intentions or the meaning of the words as they were written provides a particular perspective on the rights that we're going to recognize, for example, as being protected by the Constitution. And so it has real implications for outcomes, although we can talk later about whether or not the means by which the justices interpret the Constitution actually matters, or if instead it's their preferences and they're using those as sort of window dressing.
Yes. Let's just pause here as we talk about the recent term with Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, Sarah Benesch here, Tim Johnson from the University of Minnesota, law professor, court scholar. You can join in on this term, your takeaways of the justices and their decisions. 800-642-1234. Tim, you know, your take on the new court and originalism when you see the six Republican appointees, three Democratic ones, the landmark rulings, and the court, you know, seemingly more laser focused on what the country's founders thought about constitutional protections. What is your take on originalism guiding this court?
Well, I mean, originalism, and I think Sarah put it exactly right, focuses on what the justices think, the framers thought about a particular part of the Constitution, and in fact, without any interpretation. And so a really strict originalist will say we only look at the words that were written in the Constitution. And that's why you get a decision written by Justice Alito in the Dobbs case that says, look, because the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or even the 14th Amendment originally when written never used the word abortion, we can't find that as a federal right within the Constitution. And it's very similar in some sense to Justice Thomas's interpretation in the New York gun control case decided this term as well, the Bruin case, where he says, look, if there's an individual right to bear arms, you cannot have a state taking away that right to bear arms without a really, really important reason for doing so, because the original meaning of the Second Amendment says it is an individual right that for all intents and purposes cannot be taken away. And so this laser focus, as you put it, really puts the country in a position of listening to justices who are only looking to what the framers had to say when they actually put pen to paper. And that gets you in a position where there is no idea of an evolving constitution in any way, whether that's an evolution of the law changing meaning or whether it's an evolution of new or different social mores. And so that really keeps us in a static position and will lead to much more conservative decisions most of the time.
When you mentioned Justice Alito and on the majority opinion in Dobbs and seeming to dismiss the idea that women have to rely on constitutional protection, and quoting here, women are not without electoral or political power. And then Alito wrote, adding that the percentage of women who register to vote and cast ballots is consistently higher than the percentage of men who do so. And I'm also wondering in this case, how does majority rule or, constitutional rights subject to popular vote inform the decisions of the court, Sarah?
Yeah, that's one of the things that, you know, one of the famous quotes from West Virginia versus Barnett, which was a flag salute case many years ago, was that, you know, we don't subject constitutional rights to a vote or to majority rule. But what the court is saying in Dobbs is that there isn't a constitutional right at stake. And that's what I think is important. So they're arguing that, of course, they're not outlawing abortion. They're putting the decision over whether or not to regulate abortion to the states. And their argument then is that women can vote and people can select their legislators. And Justice Thomas and the late Justice Scalia were famous for talking about that. You know, we have these things called legislatures. We have this thing called voting. So if you agree that there is no constitutional right to abortion or to say privacy or bodily integrity, then it's acceptable, right, to push this decision to the states. If you disagree with that, and that's what Roe and Casey did, right, they disagreed with that premise and said that there was a constitutionally cognizable and protected right to abortion, then you're left a little frustrated with this language of sort of majority rule.
Tim, what do you make of the back and forth on majority rule in this court?
Well, I mean, I think the real issue is that one of the keys to law in the United States, and especially to how the U.S. Supreme Court interprets law, is that we like the law to be stable and equal across the entire country. And when you throw decisions like whether a woman has bodily integrity for anything medical or any other part of her body, including the ability to obtain abortion on demand, when you put that back to the states, we already know that there are probably going to be 26 states when push comes to shove that will outright ban abortion. Whether there will be exceptions to that or not is still to be seen. But that now means that women in some states, in Minnesota, for example, will have a right that women in other states, in Wisconsin, quite possibly, for example, that they don't have. And that's not sort of the bedrock principle of law in the United States. We like to have everyone have the exact same rights so that we're not having to say people in California are treated differently than people in Utah, than in Minnesota or in Wisconsin. And decisions like Dobbs and this idea of throwing things back to state legislatures, whether they're big or small legal issues, really leads to that disparity in the rights that we hold across the country. And that ultimately is a real problem for the law and for all citizens.
University of Minnesota law professor Timothy Johnson with us. Sarah Benish here, associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, as we discuss significant Supreme Court rulings this year, the takeaways, what the decisions mean for our country. You can join in on your impressions of the high court, the rulings that stand out as most consequential to you. Maybe they align with you or they challenge your belief systems. 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show. There's more SCOTUS conversation in a moment on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the most significant Supreme Court decisions this year, what they mean to you, with a pair of court watchers. Join in on specific rulings, how the justices engaged on cases, the dynamics of the court in light of a gridlocked partisan Congress. 800-642-1234. University of Minnesota law professor Timothy Johnson is here. And associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, Sarah Benish, stays with us. Let's take a call now. Sean is with us from Burlington. Sean, hi. What's on your mind?
I think the Supreme Court is just cherry picking and, quite frankly, not going back to the original intent. The Fourth Amendment in the Bill of Rights states that persons have a right to be secure in their persons from unwarranted government intrusion, essentially. That's a right to privacy right there. And the Ninth Amendment says that the rights the enumeration of rights herein should not be construed to eliminate other rights that are held by the people. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but that's a right. That's stating that if it's not written down, it's still a right that can be retained by the people. So the Alito's assertion that something isn't explicitly stated isn't a right is just, it's wrong. And I mean, it's just from a layman's purpose of plain language, it's just, they got it wrong. And they're
Sean, thanks for the call. I just want to pause there, Sean, and take it to Sarah first. Go ahead, Sarah.
Yeah, Sean is exactly right. If we focus, if the court had focused in Dobbs on a right to privacy or a right to bodily integrity, I think there's a lot of historical evidence that those rights were recognized at the time of the founding and beyond. Sean is exactly right about the location of the right to privacy in the Constitution, which the court outlined in the first case recognizing that right, which was Griswold versus Connecticut, a case on the use of birth control. And so there's certainly ways to find privacy and bodily integrity in the Constitution. But what Alito did, and Sean calls it cherry picking, I think that's an interesting term. What Alito did instead is he focused on the word abortion, right? So he looked for the word abortion in the Constitution and didn't find it. He then looked through history and found evidence that abortions were not something that were protected rights in the past, and decided on that basis. Now, of course, we wouldn't expect abortion to be something that would be protected historically, given the historical position of women in society. So it's likely not anything that ever occurred to anyone to make sure that women had some sort of bodily integrity that was specific to their reproduction. But that's the way he framed it. So yes, we could say that that is cherry picking. We could talk about it as window dressing, but it is the focus that the court took. And so that's where the court ends up.
Timothy, anything to add there?
You know, I would say that this is the epitome of originalism, right? And I think Sarah's absolutely right with the focus on abortion. An originalist will say if the word is not in the Constitution, then it is not something, if we're talking about rights, that needs to be protected. And actually, the comparison, not from a justice who was ideologically conservative, but one who was more ideologically liberal, and that was one of FDR's appointees, Hugo Black, was a literalist or an originalist as well. And so he made very interesting distinctions about protecting freedom of speech. And if something came out of your mouth or was written down that was protected, but if it was symbolic speech, possibly something like burning the American flag, then he certainly would not have voted to protect that right, even though he never decided on flag burning specifically. But I also find that the phrase cherry picking interesting, because absolutely, in deciding Griswold, the court did find the right to privacy, not only in the Fourth and the Ninth Amendments, but also in the First Amendment, freedom of association, the Third Amendment, that prohibits the government prohibits the government from forcing you to quarter soldiers, and then in the due process and equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment. And Justice Alito really wipes all of that away with his originalist interpretation of just the word abortion in Dobbs.
You mentioned the 14th Amendment. What do recent decisions say about the court's views on privacy rights and equal protection under the 14th Amendment?
So the court hasn't spoken on privacy specifically under the 14th Amendment really since Griswold, to be perfectly honest, although there's some interpretation in both Roe and Casey as to that effect. But when you then, that takes you to Justice Thomas's concurring opinion. Of course, none of the others in the majority signed his opinion, but he talks about pushing the idea of originalism all the way to possibly the idea of contraception. And he's talking about that clearly in the context of Griswold versus Connecticut that Sarah mentioned already. But what he's really talking about is not outlawing contraception again, but really having the court reconsider the general right to privacy. And that is a much broader issue, because that opens up a completely new avenue for the court to restrict liberties and protections that we as Americans have enjoyed for well over 100 years at this point.
University of Minnesota law professor there, Timothy Johnson, associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, Sarah Benish, on this court term, what it says, what it means going forward. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Annalisa is in Green Bay. Annalisa, what would you like to bring up?
Well, I'm far from a constitutional scholar. So
that's okay.
This whole question of throwing things back to the states regarding abortion, I guess I'm thinking about slavery. Wasn't that an argument around the time before the Civil War that this was a state's option? And so I don't know, how do they reconcile that, I guess, is what I'm asking. So that would be my question.
Timothy, go ahead.
Sure. I mean, slavery is taken care of with the Civil War amendments. And so while, in fact, that certainly was a states' right debate in terms of allowing new states into the United States as either slaveholding states or non-slaveholding states, that's an issue that really was subsumed, if you will, by the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
So there's so much partisan gridlock in Congress that it can't maybe check the powers of the judicial branch. And you know, the legislative branch feels weak in this moment. And I wonder, Sarah, what you think about the equal powers of government right now.
I think the government is in a difficult position right now, not only because of the gridlock and the hyper-partisanship, but also because of legitimacy. And I think, you know, we're seeing far fewer people answer surveys to say that they have trust or confidence in any of the branches of government anymore, which puts all of the branches in difficult positions. And I think that's especially important when we look at some of the other trends and some of these other decisions at the Supreme Court, including the EPA case. I'm not an administrative law scholar, so I'm hoping Tim will help me with these. But part of what the court is saying in some of the administrative law cases, which seem to be of great interest to this particular court, is that if Congress doesn't specifically empower an administrative agency to make rules and to govern specific areas of policy, then those administrative agencies can't do it. This is the question of deference to administrative agencies. We sort of put, for many years, we've put the onus on the administrative agencies, given that they are the experts. So the EPA, for example, ought to be considered the expert in environmental regulations. And now this court is questioning that and saying that if Congress doesn't specifically empower it to answer certain specific major questions, then it can't do so.
And we're gonna pause there, Sarah, and pick this up. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. How is America impacted by the Supreme Court rulings this year? We probed that question as we examine blockbuster cases this term. One commentary by the Heritage Foundation said it will likely go down as one of the most momentous and memorable terms in history, not just citing Roe, but an unprecedented leak of a draft opinion and protesters it cited showing up at justices' homes. Join in, 800-642-1234. Timothy Johnson here, University of Minnesota law professor whose books include Oral Arguments and Decision-Making on the U.S. Supreme Court. And Sarah Benesch, chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee, stays with us. And Sarah kicked us off on what could be perhaps considered one of the most important environmental cases. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the case of West Virginia versus EPA. Let's bring in a call on that. Nate in Milwaukee, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I was going to say two important cases this court's been bad on is the idea of major issues. And it takes a little explaining, sorry. Basically, Congress already authorized and created the EPA with the Clean Air Act. And then the court is going backwards and saying, well, since they didn't specifically mention global warming at the time they did the Clean Air Act, the EPA can't regulate it, even though pollution and making better standards for all the emissions that different things put out is what the EPA does. So basically, this court is creating arbitrary rules, and it's an activist court because of that. And one of the things that I also find just ironic is that they say that we have voting in elections, yet one of the other issues this court is basically undermining people on is with gerrymandering and voting rights. They've been undermining the idea that the people elect the legislature that is supposed to represent them.
And we're going to get to voting rights in just a little bit, Nate. But taking that first segment there, Sarah, on thoughts on the EPA case. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I was going to talk about at the end of the last segment was this idea that you mentioned of a gridlocked Congress, because I think that's really important when we start thinking about these administrative agency cases. If the court's going to require Congress to be very specific, and Congress can't really pass anything right now, it's going to be really difficult for any of these agencies to get the powers that they need to deal with something like climate change.
Timothy, you know, some supporters of the ruling really keyed in on the court's embracing of the major questions doctrine, this legal idea that says federal agencies need explicit authorization from Congress to decide issues of major economic and political significance. What do you make of that idea wrapped up in this decision?
Well, I mean, what it really suggests is even though the court didn't overturn the 1984 decision that controls the major questions doctrine, known as Chevron, the Chevron case from almost more than three decades ago now, or right about there, what it really suggests is an even more hamstrung administrative agency or more hamstringing, if you will, of administrative agencies. And that is, as Sarah put it, because Congress cannot get anything passed right now. And even in times when Congress can get legislation passed, Congress moves slowly. And most members of Congress are not experts in any particular area, whether that's environmental law or tax regulation, or you name the regulations that we're talking about. The real experts are the lifetime workers within administrative agencies. But then the flip side of that is you have questions of democracy, right? Because administrators within agencies like the EPA are not elected to office, and they actually serve at the pleasure of the president in most cases, with some exceptions. And so the public really has no say or no oversight, if you will, over those agencies. And so now you're really stuck with a decision like the West Virginia case, because now the EPA cannot act, but Congress probably is not going to act. But the big point here is this is just not an environmental case. This decision applies to all administrative agencies at this point that will be dealing with what would be major questions of doctrine or questions of policy in the United States. And so I think everyone who works in an executive agency is now scrambling to figure out what they can do and what they cannot do, and when lawsuits are going to come to try to stop them from carrying out policies to protect things like the people in the United States from climate change, for example, in this case.
I want to spend some time on church and state, the role of religion in society. Switching gears here, we talked about several Supreme Court decisions this term that addressed separation of church and state, and talked to Freedom From Religion Foundation co-president Annie Laurie Gaylor on the decision that ruled in favor of a high school football coach who refused to stop leading post-game prayers.
It is a very shocking decision in that it clearly signals that the majority, the extremist supermajority on our Supreme Court, are ready to start repealing 75 years of firm Supreme Court precedent against religious indoctrination in our public schools.
Sarah, how could this court's decisions this term affect the expression of religious beliefs in public spaces?
I think the court is taking a really interesting stand in this conflict that sort of naturally arrives between free exercise clause and the establishment clause of the First Amendment. So, you know, we all have the right to practice religion as we wish. And so, of course, Coach Kennedy has the right to pray. But the question is, when does that right start to interfere with the protection against an establishment of religion, which means that the state cannot come down on the side of one religion over the other, or on the side of religion over non-religion. And the court is really preferring free exercise at this moment in its history, especially Christian free exercise, and really kind of taking away from states in several cases the ability to guard against establishment clause violations. And so the Kennedy case is one example of that. The Carson versus Macon case about the Maine high school funding programs is another one of those kinds of cases. There have been others in the past.
Striking down the Maine program that provided public funding for students to attend private schools, but prohibited the use of state money at schools that provide religious instruction.
Right.
And Timothy, what, you know, going back to the praying football coach, it undercut a 1971 precedent known as the Lemon Test. Go a little bit into that. How was this decision, how will that affect public officials trying to avoid government entanglement with religion?
Right. So under the Lemon test, which is a three-prong test, the court likes to often have more than one prong within a test to decide, in particular in religion cases, whether or not there is a violation of separation of church and state or the idea of an establishment of religion. In this case, as you asked specifically about the prong on excessive entanglement, the idea in Lemon and it was added specifically in that case, was that you don't want the government to be excessively involved with religious institutions, if you will. So in that case, it was about whether or not the government was going to have to go in and check pay sheets or any of the spreadsheets that were used in religious schools to make sure that teachers who were teaching things that were paid for by public funds were not teaching religious things that falled under the rubric of religion. That would excessively entangle government with a religious institution. In this case, the argument would be if the government has to go in and check every single time a teacher or a coach is praying, whether or not they are praying in a way that would be suggestive of an established religion, in this case, Christianity within a public school, that might lead to excessive entanglement. And the court actually rejected that analysis. And for all intents and purposes, even though it didn't say it, overturned Lemon versus Kurtzman. Now, Roe v. Wade was overturned in Dobbs, and that's from 1973. Lemon has been in existence since 1971. And so that's an even older precedent that was, for all intents and purposes, overturned by the court. And I agree with Sarah that essentially what the court is doing and has done over the past several terms, and maybe all the way back to when Chief Justice Roberts became chief 17 years ago or 17 terms ago, is really sort of excised the Establishment Clause from the First Amendment and put all of its focus on the Free Exercise Clause. And that is, we are going to protect people's right to free exercise, even if it is someone who is a public official, or in this case, a coach of a public school football team that has influence over large numbers of students.
We have University of Minnesota Law Professor Timothy Johnson with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, Sarah Benesch here, as we talk about recent rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court, what they mean for America. 800-642-1234. Jerry is joining us from Chippewa Falls. Jerry, what's coming up for you on this term?
Good morning. See, you made the point about the EPA not being elected by the people, and that was the Supreme Court part of their ruling, I believe, is that they don't, you know, they're not elected, so but they're making laws that affect people. The Supreme Court's not elected. How in the world? They're appointed. And they're making all these decisions. I mean, I can't believe that we can't elect our own Supreme Court justices. I mean, why can't they serve terms? The decisions they're making, I mean, they affect everybody. And we have no say.
Jerry, thank you for that. Sarah, you first.
Well, there's a decision that was made by the framers of the Constitution to try to enable the Supreme Court of the United States to be independent. And there's this trade-off between independence and accountability. And all the states in the U.S. Make decisions over that balance. So do we want a more independent court, or do we want a more accountable court? Obviously, accountable courts are elected and independent courts are appointed. And so there's a lot to be said for an independent court in terms of the rule of law and protections against majority overreach and those sorts of things. But that said, he's right. There's a lot of discussion right now about court reforms that might bring the court more in line with public opinion, more in line with being a less counter-majoritarian, more representative institution, including term limits, including changing the size of the court. And I think those are all getting a little bit more traction given the activism of this particular court.
Timothy, I want to pick up on that because, you know, we have seen lawmakers on Capitol Hill most recently following the Roe decision, the Dobbs decision, you know, should President Biden increase the size of the court or impose term limits, or should the court have a code of ethics so that we can see more transparency, have more sunlight in terms of conflicts of interest with, potential, groups or lobbies? What are your thoughts there?
So, you know, all of these are ideas, as Sarah said, that are being floated around, and some are easier to accomplish than others, but all are very difficult to accomplish when push comes to shove. So let's just take the idea of increasing the size of the court. The court has been at 9 justices since 1869, right? So right around 160 years, we have not changed the number, even when President Franklin Roosevelt, while there was pushback in Congress and from the public, actually had the votes in Congress, if in the end push came to shove, to be able to increase the size. And even then, the size was not increased. The reason that that's sort of the easiest path is that would just take a majority of both houses of Congress to pass such a bill and then the president to sign it. The reason it's difficult right now is that there are two senators, one from West Virginia and one from Arizona, Senators Manchin and Sinema, who have basically told President Biden that they will not vote to increase the number. But that would be the easiest route if there were enough votes in the Senate. There's certainly enough votes in the House. But to do something like term limits actually would take a constitutional amendment, because the interpretation of Article 3 by not just the U.S. Supreme Court, but by everybody who is, or essentially everybody who's ever interpreted Article 3, is that because federal judges sit in times of good behavior, that means they have lifetime tenure. So the only way to impose term limits at the federal level for the Supreme Court as well as the lower federal courts would be to pass a constitutional amendment. And please note that the Constitution has only been amended 27 times in the entire history of the United States. And so that is not an easy route. These are all things that would, as Sarah pointed out, make the court more accountable, but they are probably not things that are going to happen anytime soon.
Timothy Johnson, U.S. Supreme Court oral hearings expert, law professor at University of Minnesota, Sarah Benesch, chair of political science at UW-Milwaukee, teaches a course on the High Court. Still time to talk about the decisions that will most affect you from this term, what you will watch for in the fall term. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation on the U.S. Supreme Court term, the decisions that came down, the major questions that surfaced after the fall of Roe last month. What other legal challenges may the court take up in the fall? 800-642-1234. Supreme Court scholars Timothy Johnson of the University of Minnesota, Sarah Benesch here of UW-Milwaukee, they stay with us. I really am eager to ask you both this question. As you've been studying the court for years and history and precedent, Timothy, you first, did anything surprise you this year out of this term, out of this court? Anything surprise you?
You know, I don't actually think anything surprised me. One could argue that the big surprise was that the chief was ineffectual in herding the six-member conservative majority. But for, as you said, all the years that Sarah and I have studied the court, it's pretty clear at this point, and it is unique because this hasn't happened in a long time, that it's not the chief's court anymore. So again, not surprising, but it was really interesting how effectual was in the court becoming Justice Thomas's court. And I think it will be for some time to come. You'll note that in both of the abortion cases that the court handed down this decision, both Whole Women's Health and the Dobbs decision, that the chief wrote separately. And I believe that the chief was trying desperately in those cases, as well as in several other cases decided this term, to try to get at least the more moderate members of the conservative majority to move and join him and at least one or two, if not all three, of the liberal democratically appointed justices. And he simply could not do so the vast majority of time. So again, not surprising, but really interesting to note that this really is, for listeners, much more the Clarence Thomas court today than it is the John Roberts court.
The draft leak opinion, didn't the draft leak opinion surprise you at all?
So I, you know, yes, I will say that I was actually thinking just in terms of opinions handed down, but yes, it certainly was surprising.
Fair
and,
enough.
And it was a bombshell. You're right. I wasn't even thinking about it in those terms. But you know what? There are going to be theories for days, weeks, months, years, decades to come as to who leaked it and why it was leaked. And Sarah and I could probably spend an entire hour on air with you talking about those particular theories. Mm-hmm. But yes, very surprising that as well. You got me.
All right. Well, Sarah, how about you? Surprises.
I mean, I was immediately thinking of the leak, so I was way ahead of him on that one. I think the leak and the reaction to Dobbs have been the things that have maybe most surprised me. And not that there was a strong reaction to the Dobbs decision, but that I'm almost seeing a difference in generational reaction to the Supreme Court. I mean, it was unheard of before this term for people to camp out in the justices' front lawns, right? And to actually bring their negative perceptions of the court's decision directly to the doorstep of the justices. I've never seen the language used in reaction to the Supreme Court. And so to me, I feel like there's a little bit of a lifting of the mythology surrounding the Supreme Court that the court has relied on for a long time for its legitimacy. And I think that's going to have some huge downstream consequences.
So looking ahead, Tim, you know, Marcus in Milwaukee brought this up, the court planning to take up a case Moore versus Harper that gives state legislatures more power over federal elections. What should we be watching in cases like this?
Right. So you're going to want to watch in those cases in particular, along with the court handed down a campaign finance decision this term that involves Senator Cruz. You're going to be seeing the court turn many more of these election type decisions back to state legislatures again. And the interesting part about that case is that the question in that case is whether the final word on things like any regulations pertaining to elections are reserved solely for state legislatures, even if state constitutions contradict what the state legislature would like to do. And that will give massive power back to the state legislature. So I think more power to state legislatures. And so you're going to see a really harder turn to the right, if you will, in those types of cases. But you're also going to see the court dealing with where personal jurisdiction lies, or where jurisdiction lies over corporations. And that gets back to some campaign finance cases from earlier in the Roberts court as well. And you're also going to see the court next term dealing again for the first time since its very important precedent, Grutter versus Bollinger, dealing with affirmative action at major universities, this case involving Harvard. So there are some additional big time cases the court has already docketed for its October 2022 term, and you can continue to expect that hard turn to the right.
Oh, thank you both so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Anytime.
Thanks for having me.
Timothy Johnson is a distinguished professor of political science and law at the University of Minnesota, writes books on SCOTUS oral arguments and decision-making. Sarah Benish, associate professor and chair of political science in the College of Letters and Science at UW-Milwaukee. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.